These are the stories I think you need to know about today. A blockbuster announcement by the Trump administration that turns the U.S. foreign policy upside down. The New York Times turns on Zelensky. Say what? Why are they doing that? I'll tell you. And is Prime Minister Modi playing word games? Is he backing Russia without really saying he's backing Russia? In a changing world, it's time for the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And we're going to begin today with a bit of a shocker. Yep. Donald Trump is intimating a divorce. Divorce? No, not Melania. He's not divorcing Melania. It's bigger than that. Donald Trump is divorcing Europe, specifically the EU and NATO. Yeah. The signs of a broken marriage have been pretty obvious, pretty much everywhere. At times, it's been even ugly. The worst fight of all just occurred about a week and a half ago, right? That's when Mr. Trump's emissaries, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, they flew to Moscow, met with President Putin, 5 hours, and then they decided to just go home, right? Leaving Mr. Zelensky and the EU representatives asking, what the hell just happened here? Well, here's what happened. Let me explain it to you. Witkoff and Kushner were scheduled to meet with Zelensky and members of NATO and the EU as well in Brussels after meeting with Mr. Putin. Reportedly, their plane was headed there to meet with Zelensky and these folks. But then suddenly, and without notice, the plane just redirected, went in a different direction. Look at this headline. This is in Le Monde. Europe sidelined and humiliated, it says. The operative word there is humiliated because, according to reports from insiders, Ursula von der Leyen and her dearest friend, Volodymyr Zelensky, felt humiliated in that moment. They were there together in Brussels waiting for the Americans. They had their best china out. Security teams were in place. Translators were seated and ready to go. And they waited for the plane to arrive. And they waited. And they waited. And waited. And waited. And the U.S. team didn't show up. They didn't even call to say that they weren't coming. I mean, ouch, right? Ultimate slap in the face. So, was it just a temporary adjustment? No. Now we know, or certainly appears to be much more like part of a major shift in the U.S. foreign policy that leaves NATO and the EU out, isolated. How do we know this? Here's how. Because of this new policy paper that was just put out. It describes a substantial change in U.S. foreign policy announced by the Trump White House. It's 33 pages long. It was put out just days ago, and it's a shocker for Europe because it calls for the U.S. to engage not with Europe's elite leaders, but rather with Europe's opposition leaders, you know, like Marine Le Pen. This is called the 2025 National Security Strategy Report. And why is it a shocker? Well, because it signals a profound shift in U.S. foreign policy. From now on, according to this report, the U.S. will be less inclined to be just a global hegemony. It's going to focus instead on pragmatism. Wow. Transactionalism. Wow. Right? Let me give you some examples, right? There's going to be a de-emphasis on past ideological positions that had become just a matter of course, right? Things like hating on China, hating on Russia. Instead, it's going to call for the Trump policy of deal-making wherever a deal is possible by engaging countries based on what those countries can offer the United States and can offer the citizens of the United States, not just what the United States has to do for them.
The American public doesn't have the appetite to fund everything for everyone all over the world with no direct benefit to themselves. So I think he can be the manager that brings that together, but everyone's going to actually have to step up and do their part and not just leave it to the United States to cover everything.
He's talking about his dad, right? And he's right. There is no question. I've said it here a million times that this is exactly what American politicians have been pushing on the American people for way too long. Just write a check. Write a check, and we'll take care of other people. No! How about taking care of Americans, right? So speaking in Doha this weekend, Donald Trump Jr., he named names. I mean, he came out a-gunning for some of these folks. He explained, for example, how the EU, how NATO, and the Zelensky government have just gotten used to Americans paying their bills for them without doing anything at all for Americans in return.
The invasion of Ukraine, I heard major leaders, Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate in the United States, saying it's the number one issue for Republicans in the United States. And I say, that's weird. I speak to Republicans all over the country every day, probably far more than Mitch has ever spoken to, despite his 379-year career in politics. I did that on a weekly basis, and I surveyed people at every talk I did. It got to the point where it was probably well over 200,000 Americans that I spoke to directly. And I'd be in a room like this, and I'd ask, is Russia-Ukraine a top three issue for anyone in the room? Nothing. Is it a top 10 issue for anyone in the room? I think I got three people that once said it was a top 10 issue. Three out of hundreds surveyed, hundreds of thousands, every weekend for 2 years.
You know, what's interesting is that he, Donald Trump Jr., went on to publicly accuse the Zelensky government of corruption, graft, and theft. He said those words and said that Zelensky has been getting away with it for years because he's a great marketer. And he was always protected by the Western media. Then, watch this. Watch what happens now. Almost as if on cue, after he says that, one of those Western media outlets that Trump Jr. says has made Zelensky, quote, a deity that is beyond reproach, that media outlet just changed its tune. Look at this. Look at this New York Times headline. The New York Times... Yes, the New York Times has just come out with this story that takes a direct shot at Zelensky, makes Europe's infatuation with him seem both naive and foolhardy. The headline spells out the fact that Zelensky's government knew about the corruption and allowed it to fester. Love that word. And here's what the Times is essentially saying in this article, right? I read it for you. That organizations in Ukraine that tried to stop the corruption were stripped of their power. That rules in Ukraine were rewritten to avoid prosecutions. And that Zelensky loyalists, this is according to the New York Times, were inserted into positions of power instead of independent arbiters to make decisions. The Times goes on to say that those actions resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. taxpayers' money being embezzled. As a result, the article's really a head shaker, and it makes one wonder, makes me wonder, why are they writing this now? Why? You know, this is something that the rest of the world, even many in the United States, kind of already knew was happening. The New York Times is, let's face it, they're a neocon newspaper. They usually follow the dictates of the U.S. administrative state. Through leaks that are given to them by the Pentagon and the State Department and weapons makers. If the New York Times, think about this, if the New York Times is willing, alas, to turn on Zelensky, that means, to me anyway, neocon world, vis-a-vis, you know, the administrative state, is likely turning on Zelensky. Because they're feeding him the information. Think about it. Right? So, maybe they're now willing to throw him under the globalist bus. But are they also willing to throw the Europeans under the bus as well? Kind of starting to look that way. Meanwhile, there's at least two world leaders right now who are not afraid to side with Russia. They do so publicly, and they just did so recently. Viktor Orban, of course, he doubled down on his criticism of Europe and the elites who run it by saying that they are drowning in corruption.
While the European Union is drowning in corruption, not only the Commission, but also the European Parliament is loud with corruption cases involving its own members. Now this corruption-soaked Brussels is supposed to say something sensible about corruption in Ukraine? This is not going to happen, because what is happening in Ukraine is also happening in Brussels. In times like this, the most we can expect is that one hand washes the other.
And while meeting with President Putin in Delhi, Prime Minister Modi came out with a bombshell of his own, as a matter of fact. He said India is no longer neutral. It is on the side of peace.
Dear Mr. President, we regularly exchange views on Ukraine. As a true friend, you tell me what is happening in this area, which is evidence of the deep trust between our countries. This is the true strength of our relations. We see that the world is undergoing many changes, but we consistently support the position of establishing peace as soon as possible, and we support all the recent efforts in this direction. And we must all work and communicate in order to strive for this, to establish peace. I am fully confident that the world will once again follow this path. Your Excellency, when I meet with world leaders, I always tell them that India is not a neutral country. India does not have a neutral position. We have our own position, which is the position of peace. We support all efforts aimed at establishing peace.
India is not neutral. It's on the side of peace. Now, Modi didn't mention his preference by name, but kind of didn't have to. By using this opportunity in front of this vast global audience to say once again, not neutral, we're on the side of peace, what's the suggestion? The suggestion is obvious to me, because it's the U.S. recently that has offered up two peace plans and have spent hours and hours and hours engaging the Russians talking about this peace plan. It's the Europeans, meanwhile, who have scoffed at both plans and instead suggested that they want to give more weapons to Ukraine so Ukraine can continue fighting the war. Unless, of course, Russia gives up all the gains that it's gotten so far and pay hundreds of billions of dollars to the Zelensky government. So the question is, as he says this, if he's on the side of peace, as he says he is, who are the ones who seem to be showing signs of looking for peace, and who are the ones who look to be like they're against it? You tell me. Joining us now from London is Adriel Kasonta. He is a lawyer. He's a political scientist. He's been part of the oldest conservative think tank in the UK. Kasonta was once fired, by the way, for simply appearing on a Russian news program. What does that sound like? I know a little bit about that experience. Adriel's good enough to join us now. It's a pleasure to have you here. I hope you can make us better understand the European mindset, because I got to tell you, it boggles the mind. The latest is that they were meeting today on Downing Street, I suppose, with Mr. Zelensky to try and figure out what their response is to what the Americans have been proposing. Mr. Zelensky, as you know, had a conversation with the White House as well, and that didn't go very well. The President of the United States said Mr. Zelensky didn't even read it. So I guess here's the question we should start with. Are the Europeans even relevant to this conversation anymore?
First of all, thank you very much, Rick, for having me in your show.
And
yes, this is a very crucial question. They became irrelevant, and they have been irrelevant for the very long time because I think that the EU made Europe as a continent brain dead. Europe, understood from the Brussels perspective, is being operating on the autopilot. Because after this, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and after the Cold War, Europeans get used to be welfare darlings of the United States. And here we are, reaching the moment where the parent is telling to its grown child that you can live on your own. You can leave the house. You can purchase, you can go to work, you can purchase your own flat and you know, simply establish your own family. But like this spoiled brat, European mandarins in Brussels, unelected mandarins, are, you know, screaming and shouting at the parent who is not punishing them, but allowing them to finally be self-reliant and take their own fate in their own hands. They are not getting used to it. That's why they are keep on trying to, you know, bringing up the quotes from Ronald Reagan, all of this, sorry to say, nonsense that is irrelevant in this new emerging multipolar world. Hmm. And I think that the new administration in the United States perfectly understands that the world that we are living in at the moment is not the world that we were even 10 years ago or 5 years ago. It's completely changed, as you've mentioned, with regards to India and state visit of President Vladimir Putin to Modi's India recently.
Yeah, you said so much there. I don't know where to grab it, but I can't wait because there's about five or six tangents there that I think are fulsome. And I'd like to drill down on them, but maybe we begin with this. Help us understand as non-Europeans. I mean, I love the UK. My wife and I honeymooned there at Stratford-upon-Avon. It's a beautiful country. France is a magnificent country. So is Spain and so is Germany. It's beautiful. But these countries don't seem to matter anymore because today Europe isn't run by Germany or France or the UK or Spain or Luxembourg or any of these countries. It's run by these two entities you mentioned, unelected. It's run by the EU and it's run by NATO. And the people of these countries didn't elect those people. That's what I'm trying to understand. How did we get to this point?
Well, we get to this point because the Europeans believe that they can recreate the United States of America by creating United States of Europe. But the main difference is, in the very famous words of the Margaret Thatcher, who was our prime minister, who said that the Europe is based on history and America is based on philosophy. And you can't just redraw all the historical differences within the European continent, specific characteristics of different countries, let's say Germany, France. Although we are all Europeans, we have different national identities.
Yeah.
And by ceding the power, which previously belonged to the elected leaders in our own countries, we became nothing. We don't matter as French. We don't even consider ourselves as French, British, Polish. We consider as ourselves as European. It makes sense when you're an American person, but it doesn't make sense at all when you have a rich history as a French person, when you have a rich history as an English person, and when you have a rich history as a Hungarian person. Hmm. So it doesn't work this way, but they try to time and time again make these inclusions into our internal affairs by forcing people to give up their national identities.
Yeah.
That's why we see such a strong backlash in France or in Germany, where the huge support for AfD.
Yeah, you know, and I'm almost thinking, my God, based on what you just said, I just put two and two together as an American, right? When I'm sitting around talking to my buddies and maybe my wife and I will say, oh, this summer we're going on vacation. We don't say we're going on vacation to the EU. We don't say we're going on vacation to visit NATO. We say we're going to go to Rome. We're going to go to London. We're going to go to visit Germany. We're going to go. We are specific about these countries because that's where the language is different, the culture is different, the experience is different, the history is different. It's almost like by creating Europe into this homogenous institution, It's lost that luster. What do we have left to hang on to when we think of Europe these days?
Well, we have a disintegrity. We have a huge backlash. We have a huge immigration into our country, which is, by the way, caused by the numerous miscalculations related to foreign expansionism or previous administration of the United States. And for instance, Iraq war, everyone just jumped like a lapdog. When George W. Bush said, well, we need to fight them Well, who was the first who was enabler of Mr. Bush? It was Tony Blair. And others also very, very willingly were, you know, siding with the United States without having their own say. And for me, because many people accuse me of being anti-American, well, it's quite strange because I grew up on, you know, watching American movies, watching American cartoons like Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles. And I am Americanized since I was a kid. Yeah. It's a complete nonsense. But in order to be a good friend, you have to say when your fellow friend is doing something wrong. This is a good friendship. Not just willingly, you know, blindly follow every step this person is doing. And I think that it was very convenient for the people in Brussels and in Europe at large to not say anything. And the good example is the recent attack on Platform X, previously Twitter, and Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. When the United States is giving money and, you know, following, fighting the European wars, imaginary threat from Moscow, it is good, America. But the moment the America is saying, listen, we are not siding with you on this one, you have to figure it out for yourself. Then there's like, you know, like the stream of attacks on America, that America is rotten to the core. America. So basically, these people are not, you know, friends of American people. They are not friends of America. Those who are dissent, like Viktor Orban, myself, I can also include myself as a friend of America, because I do believe that this is mm-hmm. a very, 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 very important civilization. But it went wrong with its hegemony. And I think that it should be a very healthy republic, which has a lot to offer to the world.
Do you get the sense that this new policy paper that was put out Friday into Saturday by the Trump administration moves in that direction? I just read words in there like pragmatism and transactionalism. Seems to me the United States is saying we're going to individually characterize our relationship with countries based on what we can do for those countries and those countries can do for us. I think that makes a lot of sense.
It is. I would say this, that I would love to see the foreign policy and strategic shift in the United States, but I don't want to hold my breath. We've seen time and time again with different administrations. Sorry to say it. I mean, you know, I'm a realistic person.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't jump on anything that I hear, because I read this 33 pages.
Yeah.
And I think that the devil is in the detail. And we've seen a lot of actions in the United States with regards to Thomas Massie, where Mr. Donald Trump, unfortunately, attacked him. In my opinion, he's a true patriot, true mm-hmm. Republican.
He is.
The Republican that I believe in, the Republican values, like the Pat Buchanan and others. He attacked Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgia senator.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of confusion. And also when it comes to the language, we see language like burden-sharing network. Well, burden-sharing network is offshore balancing, in my understanding, because I studied international relations at London School of Economics, and I perfectly understand what is a propaganda and how to masquerade certain things in the language. So I want to believe that this burden-sharing network, where America is incentivizing countries who are paying, I don't know, this 5% of GDP for the security, willing to help, but will it change something, the huge animosity in Eastern Europe, including Poland, towards Russia?
Well,
I don't think.
Will you give Mr. Trump at least this? It's a far cry from the hegemonious environment created by his predecessor. No?
That's true. I completely agree with that. And I think that that's why we see such outcry in numerous European and even American outlets, that, you know, that this is a clear break from the, you know, this post-Cold War dogma.
Yeah.
That's why everyone is freaking out. Because they don't understand what they don't even understand what can happen again next. They don't read they don't see what is written on the wall, because they are fixed in their, you know, in their dogma, in this orthodoxy that is almost like blasphemous mm-hmm. for them to, you know, to break even with that language, not even actions itself. So we have orthodoxy, neocon/neoliberal orthodox, who are willing to burn this continent in order to stick to outdated world, which, as we can see, I mean, in Doha summit, where Donald Trump Jr. clearly said that he's not willing to, you know, to echo chamber what the European capitals are saying with regards to Ukraine and this unnecessary conflict.
Yeah, it makes me think of Piers Morgan when you just said that. Whenever I watch Piers Morgan, it's like he has these outdated ideas in his head. And when he says them to people, I'm sitting there and half the world is sitting there going, what in the hell are you talking about? Yes. That's the way we used to think 20, 30 years ago, but that's not the way we think anymore. The Chinese are not sneaky. The Russians don't have bears walking around everywhere. The Indians are not going to succumb to whatever the hell we want to do because everything they've ever done is post-Gandhi. I mean, this crazy thinking that exists in the minds of idiots like that. And a lot of people in Europe see, I mean, I hear the von der Leyens and the Rutas and... Who are these people, by the way? I've been doing a little bit of research on them lately, Adriel. Seems to me like they're all bankers. Like, none of them are really schooled thinkers in terms of the things that you and I are talking about right now, for example.
No, they don't have as a matter of fact, I've spent quite some time in Brussels working for the European Parliament for its Committee on Foreign Affairs, and I can tell you that they use people like myself who are educated in order to explain to them certain realities and certain contexts and terms, because those people are, I don't know, they are educated in chemistry, in finance. They don't have a clue about what is geopolitics, what is politics. They don't have a clue. They're completely numb. Sorry to say it, but they don't have a clue. And many young people, they see opportunity in order to peddle this warmongering, you know, narrative. Because as you probably know, there's a lot of money to be made when you are siding with the old media establishment and the, arms contractors. This is how they, you know, searching for the young, you know, young people when they go to the European Parliament. They are scouting people who can write nice policy papers, and they offer them a lot of money in order to peddle the word propaganda. I have been many times throughout my career, both in the European Parliament, in UK Parliament, approached by many different peoples, many different companies in order to sell myself on the altar of war propaganda. But I'm here now with you after all these years. And since 2014, when I published my first paper with regards to the Maidan revolution or coup, the Etat, I stick to my guns and I'm lucky.
Well, you better be careful. You know, you're talking on what is a Russian network. So now someone's going to come after you and call you a Putin apologist for having an open dialogue.
They already done it. The Times called me. I remember after I published my first paper in 2014, the Times called me the blue Tory friend of Vladimir Putin. That was the first hit. And I was a very young man, and I couldn't comprehend that there is a strong warmongering machinery. We only heard this, you know, in the TV, but I've experienced it myself and my family included, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's back to that Piers Morgan mentality, and I think we'll just call it the Piers Morgan way, which is basically you don't argue with facts. You basically just, anytime you hear somebody say something you don't like or you don't understand, you just tie them to Putin, and that's all you have to do, and you think you've won the argument, but that's changing. I don't think in most of the world that flies anymore. It's kind of like anytime you criticize Israel, all you got to do in the old days is say, well, you're an anti-Semite, and that's it, you won the argument. That's not the case anymore either. The world is changing, Adriel.
Yes, it is changing. It basically due to the loss of power of the mainstream media. Because of the social media like X, Platform X, we can see what is happening in Gaza. We can see what is happening in Germany, that in almost 91 cities, including Berlin and Munich, young people are protesting, saying that we want to be fit for peace, not fit for war. Hmm. So young generation also has an opportunity to travel around the world. But this is the boomer mentality where they, kept the cap on the national fears of the other, of the alien, civilization. Russians are, crazy, savages who will just come here and destroy us. They will rob us. They are, they are bankrolling and they are, making London City corrupted. Trust me, London City is very much corrupted without Russian money. And I also work in Canary Wharf, so I know what I'm saying. So by naming those people, they are simply, banking on those old impulses and old sentiments, which are very true for the older generation. But the new generation is having an opportunity to much broader sources of information like TikTok. That's why there was a huge problem with TikTok. That's why we have a problem with Twitter, because any independent platform which is providing alternative voices is being tried by establishment, by the global elite to be destroyed, because this is how they lose their cap on the global perception of what is true and what is not.
Aside from the general hypocrisy, which I allude now to the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned Iraq a couple of times, that NATO and the EU and a lot of these European leaders are wagging their finger at Russia and saying, how dare you attack Ukraine, when they, in fact, attacked Belgrade, attacked Afghanistan, attacked Iraq, as you said, attacked Yemen. I mean, hell, I could go on and on. There's a general hypocrisy just involved in that. But even if we just put that aside, can you explain to us what the general motivation is for Europe and Europe's elites being hell-bent on either wanting to be at war with Russia or claiming that Russia is going to attack them tomorrow?
Well, sorry to say, but it is a European supremacy and racial supremacy, because, unfortunately, Russia isn't being considered as a European state. Whenever you have a conversation like, really like hardcore European Atlanticists, when they discuss Russia, they call it an Asian country, which is a smear, a racial smear towards Russia. And their supremacy, like what we see, what is happening even in Africa, why France is so angry with Moscow liberating or helping countries to be more independent, like Nigeria and others, because it is, destroying their grip on the natural resources and helping those nations to stand on their feet. And this is the reason that they need to destroy Russia, because they need to prove their point. Second, they want to hold the grip on vast natural resources of Russia, which is also important for the declining economies. And three, they want to punish Russia, that Russia is nothing what they've been preaching for all of these years. We've heard that, Russia will be defeated in the, I don't know how many months, that Russian economy is sinking. I mean, look at the British economy. Look at the German economy. Look at the popularity of so-called leaders, Macron, Merz, and look at the popularity of Vladimir Putin. Another lie, that Russia is isolated. I don't think Russia is isolated. Even the recent, greeting, how the India greeted him with the royal fanfare. This is, they melted down. I'm sure that you read Reuters, Bloomberg, all of this. Even that's why Bloomberg recently did an interview with Salman Rushdie, raising the topic of Hindu nationalism. Coincidence? I don't think so.
Yeah.
This is a corporate punishment of the country which is independent and showing a middle finger, sorry to say, because Tucker Carlson recently showed a middle finger on the really nice photo from Doha to all of these haters, to the establishment in Brussels and also in Washington, D.C., to the neocons in Washington, D.C., that this is not true. And everyone, outside of this European bubble or Western bubble knows that Russia is a normal country, China is a normal country. So whenever I speak to people from other countries, they are just, they can't even understand what is going on, whether we went crazy.
Russians are weird, just like the rest of the world is weird. And Chinese are weird, just like everybody. I mean, we're all the same. Yeah. We're all normal and we're weird and we have our hang-ups and we have our issues and people are people.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right. I do believe, and I've heard tell by others, that not only do they look at them, and you're right, it's a demeaning way of talking about them. Well, they're not really Europeans, they're Asians. But then they also have this Slav mentality that they think they're not like the rest of us because they're not Western, really Western. They're Slavs. So there really is, I think, a general discriminatory tone in the way the Europeans react to the Russians. But then the Ukrainians are pretty much the same. Why do they welcome them? Because they find them useful, perhaps?
Yes, they are useful idiots. And unfortunately, this plan has been in the making long before what happened in 2014. I happened to speak Polish, and I read many books in Polish, and I know Slavic languages very well. And Roman Dmowski, who was one of the creators of Polish independence, wrote in 1930 that Ukraine sooner or later will become a place where all the global powers would try to, to steal the natural resources, to be corrupted, and to be a base to attack Russia. Yeah. And these words are, he's laughing from the grave. Many conservatives in Poland are saying, like true conservatives, they say that Roman Dmowski is laughing from the grave, because everything what is happening, the corruption scandals, even before, we know from The Guardian that Mr. Zelensky was mentioned in Pandora Papers, but no one cared. When we talk about Nazism, we need to fight Nazis, never again. All of these slogans that we've been fed in high school, in school, all of these years. What is Azov Battalion? They are, marching, they have a Nazi insignia, and what? I should go and die for these people? Like, really?
Yeah.
Really?
It's a hell of a good question. Let's, as we wind this down, let's go to the news. Let's start with the apparent conversation between the Americans and Mr. Zelensky. It appears Mr. Zelensky said, I think the words he used, don't quote me, are, it was difficult and a very tough conversation. I think the Americans are very much pressuring him, and they're trying to speed up the conversation to get him to agree on anything, but he doesn't seem willing to agree on anything, certainly not when it comes to territory. What do you make of that?
Well, I make it very simple. If someone is sponsoring you and giving you the extension on your life, because this is what America is doing, without America, Ukraine would fall. You just listen and you shut up your mouth, sorry to say it. Mm. If I have a sponsor, well, I have to listen to my sponsor. And without the United States, Ukraine wouldn't last any day longer. So I think that Mr. Zelensky is playing with a fire, because he can push too far, and the Americans can reach a conclusion that he is the main obstacle to the peace in Ukraine, and might somehow remove him or contribute to his removal by simply reestablishing democratic elections, which were banned by this autocrat.
Yeah.
Sorry to say it, but this is true. So Mr. Zelensky is now touring United Kingdom and Europe, doing this op-ed pictures, like, for Instagram, because this is who he is. He is a con man who tricked the entire nation into unnecessary war. And sooner or later, even his own people, because I also have friends who are Ukrainians, will go after his head.
I just read this weekend, I didn't know this, according to members of parliament in Ukraine who are very critical of Mr. Zelensky, they're accusing him of spending $4 billion on a marketing and public relations campaign to basically lift his brand so that he can go around the world doing essentially what you just said, and I guess what he's doing today on Downing Street, meeting with the British royalty and elites, et cetera, et cetera. $4 billion? So as an American or as a Brit, you sent him your hard-earned tax money, and he's using it on Instagram and to do publicity
tours?
Basically,
this is what it is.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, this is what it is. This is what it is. That's why there's a huge outrage. When you talk to average people, we constantly hear that maybe we will need to go and defend Ukraine. Well, you know what? I go to the gym, I go to the public spaces, I see young, very, well-built Ukrainian man wearing nice clothes, driving nice cars in London. Why they should not go if they are so patriotic? Why should I go and die fighting against Russia, which I think should be an ally of Europe, Instead of this, you know, guys who are flashing with the money in London City, they are so patriotic, but they like to go to the gym. They like to go to the five-star restaurants and, you know, dine and dive and go to Monaco. No, I don't buy it. And many Brits are also not buying it. This is even causing anger when you start hearing Ukrainian language when you are in the public space. And you see all of this man with the children and women. I don't have anything against that. But, you know, the priorities. If the Ukrainians themselves don't want to fight, why should we fight for them?
Yeah, that's a hell of a good question. You're asking too many good questions. I can see why you got in trouble. Finally, if it's true what you seem to be intimating, that there is a ruination taking place in Ukraine, maybe even a government collapse soon, what will be the effect of that on the European elites? What's going to happen to the EU that's also under a corruption probe, and NATO, et cetera, et cetera?
Unfortunately, I think that when you are being threatened, like Mr. Netanyahu was threatened with the, you know, with his corruption trial in Israel. Mm. If they are, you know, pushed to the limit, they will start, you know, going to war. That's what we see in Germany. The Bundestag that just implemented the so-called voluntary service in army, which can subscription, but it can be turned anyway. That if the number is not sufficient, yes, the devil is in the language. Yeah. If the number is insufficient, and we know that the number will not be sufficient, then you will be forced. So basically, to mask all of this misjudgment, all of this propaganda, they will set. They prefer to kill their own people. They prefer to destroy the continent in order to save their own.
Wow.
This is very sad, and this is what Viktor Orban is saying. He's trying to protect his own country, its own people from annihilation, because we would be annihilated in the European war with Russia. Mm. And this is what, unfortunately, I think it's going to happen. But I think that I hope that the United States will prevent, with its power and influence, these maniacs and crazy loons from pushing the European citizens into an unwinnable war.
I'm going to be meeting tomorrow with the Hungarian foreign minister to pick up part of the conversation that you were just mentioning there, because I think you're absolutely right. The Hungarians have been kind of ahead of the game when it comes to Europeans, and pointing out that many of the actions that have been taken by the elites in Europe and certainly in the EU have been foolhardy, and that it's leading to the eventuality of its own potential collapse and certainly its own bankruptcy. But time will tell. What a great conversation. Adriel Cassanta, what a wonderful conversation and what a great opportunity. I hope you'll come back again, because I've really enjoyed sharing with you and learning from you a perspective that's different, because you're there. You're there in the hot nest, as they say, in the UK right now. You're in London, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. By the way, I'm curious, before I let you go, the average Londoner, do they get it?
Of course, they have.
I saw Starmer's down to 12%, so they obviously are not happy.
No, the British citizens are not stupid. You know, there's a joke, with all due respect, even the scaff holders know what is happening in geopolitics more than our elites. So with all due respect to our scaff holders, because I really respect our working class people who, you know, build this country and they don't want, and they are the greatest patriots, working class people, not the elites, because they will eventually escape. Maybe they will travel to Miami. I don't know. To Florida. I don't know. Hmm. But the actual people, the working class people, will be forced to defend their country against even their own will, because no one sees Russia. They just want to, you know, go along with their lives. They want to have a decent job. They want to afford, you know, put the bread on their table. They want to afford, you know, during the winter to pay their bills, electricity bills, and just want to leave, you know, get along with other people. And I never seen in my entire life an average people having some problems with Chinese, with Russians, with Ukrainians. No. Yeah. If you're a good person, you're a good person. If you are, you know, if you are someone who is dislikable, you will be dislikable.
Exactly.
This is the general rule. This is the general rule.
The only place where everybody is good is in Miami, because it happens to be my hometown.
Oh, sorry to mention that. Anyways.
I kid because I can. Thank you, my friend. I very much, once again, enjoyed the conversation, and we'll look forward
Likewise.
To seeing you
Thank
next
you,
time. All right. Let's do what we always like to do about this time, and that is talk to you about some of the folks who've been watching, and they want to, you know, they want to chime in, as they say, as well. We start with the rational thinker. He says, one thing you got wrong, Indians want Russia, not because they got cheap oil, but Russia has got India's back since decades when the USA turned its back on India. Thank you, Mr. Rational Thinker. Canada says, if some Westerner still thinks it's not their own leaders that cause all the problems in the world, then I don't think even God can help you. Next, Mullah says, dude, India and Russia are civilizations. The West is a baby, and you don't know anything about the resilience of civilization and culture. Me? Okay, I'll take the heat. And Gaurav says, a day without hypocrisy is a day wasted. West. I suppose that's how they see it. Hey, thanks so much for being with us. We certainly appreciate you being there. And you can watch me on YouTube. The channel's called Journalistically Speaking. And always, always feel free to leave your thoughts there. I'm also on X, by the way. Big conversations take place there. I'll be talking about that tomorrow. I've been noticing a trend on X that I'm going to mention to you during our show, either tomorrow or the next day. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks so much for being with us, and thank you for allowing us into your homes.